Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 9, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we have our first call in our executive orders series, and we will be discussing President Trump's one-in, two-out executive order. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor Susan Dudley, who is a director at the George Washington University Regulatory Studies Center, and Jitinder Kohli, who is a managing director in the public sector practice at Deloitte Consulting. I will turn it over to Professor Dudley to get us started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A, so please do think of questions to be asking of our experts. Thank you both for speaking with us. Susan, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Nate. So what we're talking about today is an executive order that President Trump signed on January 30th. It was titled Reducing Regulation and Controlling Regulatory Costs. The day after the order came out, a Wall Street Journal editorial enthusiastically compared it to a dam for the regulatory flood, while the Washington Post quoted the president of the Union of Concerned Scientists as saying it was absurd and posed a Sophie's choice for regulatory agencies. And then just yesterday, several NGOs and unions filed a complaint with the D.C. Court for the District of Columbia, arguing that the order exceeds the president's constitutional authority, violates the Take Care Clause of the Constitution, and directs agencies to engage in arbitrary and capricious actions. So what does this controversial order do? It essentially, it implements the president's promise on the campaign trail to eliminate two regulations for every new regulation. I think the order has the potential to motivate better evaluation of the effects of existing regulation and to foster regulatory or to force regulatory agencies to make hard choices about regulatory priorities without forsaking their regulatory objectives. But there is a lot of confusion about what the order actually does and doesn't do, so I appreciate the Federalist Society hosting this call today. So I am going to provide a brief overview of the order's requirements and then hand things off to Jitinder Kohli, who managed the Better Regulation Executive in the UK when it first conceived of its one-in, one-out policy, which, by the way, has since grown into a one-in, three-out policy. And I'll also just mention briefly that Canada also has a policy that they call one-for-one, a policy that requires regulations to be offset, the cost of regulations. So the order refers to a budgeting process, but it does not call for a strict regulatory budget that's comparable to the fiscal budget. I think that's a good thing, because a true regulatory budget would require the government to quantify the current costs of all existing regulations, which is not only next to impossible, but even if it were done, it wouldn't be all that meaningful. So instead, the order imposes two separate constraints. The first is this requirement that agencies eliminate two regulations for every new one they issue. But the second is a cap on incremental regulatory costs. So since the agencies can meet the two-for-one requirement by trading off two minor regulations for one really big one, I think the incremental cost cap will be the more binding of the two constraints. In the current fiscal year, the order sets that cap at zero. And that means for every dollar of cost imposed by new regulations, agencies would have to find offsets of an equal dollar amount by either eliminating or modifying existing regulations. And then the order says for future years, the director of OMB will have to establish an incremental cost allowance for each agency each year. So as with other orders that have received more attention lately, it seems to have been put in place with rather limited internal review and has left OMB, which, as you know, is still waiting for the president's nominee for director, Mick Mulvaney, to be confirmed. It left OMB to fill in the details. So OMB, at the end of last week, released a draft interim guidance and has requested comments on it by tomorrow. So one of the big questions the OMB guidance seeks to resolve is what regulations will be covered. So what counts as the ins and what counts as the outs? So the order itself provides a very broad definition of regulation. And the OMB's draft guidance focuses on significant regulations, which narrows the list to about 200 or 300 regulatory actions a year. I think this is appropriate, and if people are interested, we can talk more about why I think so in Q&A. Interestingly, the guidance says that rules vacated by the courts would generally not count as offsets, but rules rescinded by the Congressional Review Act or other acts of Congress would. For the incremental cost cap, the guidance directs agencies to estimate the opportunity cost to society. That's a measure that's more comprehensive and more difficult to measure than the units that Canada uses. Canada's one-for-one policy focuses on administrative burdens or paperwork burdens. And it's also, and I'm curious what Jitinder thinks about this, it's a little more comprehensive than the business compliance cost, which the UK uses for their policy. And when accounting for offsets, agencies are supposed to estimate the cost that would be avoided by modifying or eliminating the rule, not the costs that they estimated when the rule was first issued. I think that's another important point that's clarified in the guidance. Putting the policy in practice is not going to be easy. Procedurally, to remove or revise existing regulations takes at least as much time and effort as developing new regulations. So the order effectively directs agencies to reallocate their internal resources away from creating new regulations, new burdens, and more towards understanding and relieving existing ones. And this raises another thing that people have been talking about. Presidents for the last 40 years have called on agencies to analyze the benefits and the costs of new regulations before they're issued. OMB's guidance on this new order makes it clear that the cost cap is not meant to supplant those longstanding requirements, and I think that's important. Benefit cost analysis is still an important requirement, but the fact is it has not constrained the scope and reach of regulation. So I see this incremental cost cap as being an overlay on top of that net benefit requirement that should motivate agencies to achieve priorities at the lowest cost. So bottom line, while the details of President Trump's executive order have yet to be worked out, it has the potential to impose some discipline on regulatory agencies, to generate a constructive debate on the real impacts of regulation, and ultimately to lead to more cost-effective achievement of public priorities. So with that summary, let me turn the phone over to Jitinder, who can speak from experience how the UK policy works.
Thank you very much, Susan, and thank you very much, Nate, as well, for organizing this session. Just to say a little bit more about my background to start with, my name is Jitinder Kohli. I work at Deloitte in the Washington, D.C. office. But what's interesting right now is that between 2005 and 2009, I was the chief executive of the part of government responsible for implementing our regulatory reform policies. And 2005 is an interesting moment in time because it's the point in time where the UK made a pivot in the way we were going, in the way the UK did regulatory reform. Prior to 2005, we said that the primary and only thing we cared about when we were bringing in new regulations was establishing that the benefits justified the costs. And then post 2005, in addition to that requirement, that the benefits should justify the cost and we should not bring in regulatory requirements unless the benefits justify the cost. We also placed new requirements on agencies to try and control the cumulative cost of regulation, the overall cost as faced by business of regulations as a whole. So very much the, you know, Susan described the executive order that came out in the US a few weeks ago It has a very similar intent and purpose to the approach that the UK adopted about 12 years ago. And that approach, as Susan described, is not unique to the UK. Similar approaches have been adopted in a number of other countries. Denmark, the Netherlands, Canada, Australia are all countries that have adopted similar approaches. So with that, as the US embarks on a similar journey, what might the lessons be for the United States, learning from international experience? And I'm going to talk about five lessons today over the next few minutes. The first lesson is that measurement matters. What the executive order does and what the UK did is it imposes new incentives which are rooted in measurement of the costs of regulation. And that's exactly what the UK has done and exactly what a number of other countries have done. There's a sort of saying in government that what gets measured gets done. And by promising to either reduce or stabilize the overall cost of regulation, there is much greater incentive in government to look for ways to try and reduce costs. And I think the other thing to mention in this area from the UK is that what matters is focusing on the real cost savings as faced by business as a result of a regulatory change. So let's take an example. If there was a requirement to have nutritional labeling on food and drinks, and that requirement was removed as a legal requirement, the reality is many businesses would choose to continue to have nutritional labeling. And so in the UK, the approach was to understand what the actual change in costs was associated with the change in the regulatory regime. And by focusing on real business costs associated with regulatory changes, we were able to do what businesses cared about most. The second message I'd say is focus on modernizing rather than eliminating. This is in the UK we called our regime the better regulation regime. We did not call it the deregulation regime, and that's because we believed that there was a mechanism to have better regulation whilst maintaining protections. And so the kind of regulatory approaches the UK tried early on as it was trying to reduce costs for business were redesigning forms so they were much easier to use, targeting inspection on those businesses that were much more likely to be non-compliant, issuing guidance that made it much easier for businesses to know what they needed to comply so they didn't have to, they didn't face the uncertainty that meant it took them a long time to work out what they needed to do. And very much the emphasis in the UK was about maintaining protections whilst at the same time minimizing the burden and cost of regulation. The third lesson from the UK and other countries has been try where possible to minimize exclusions. These policies work if they're broad brush and they touch every part of government. And while that is difficult and there's always a need for some kind of exclusion, the wider the exclusions are, the more difficult it is to make a policy stick and have any real impact. And certainly in the US, one question that will emerge in the coming weeks is what do the exclusions, there are some exclusions in the executive order around military, national security, foreign affairs, regulations relating to agency organization, management personnel, and indeed any other category exempted by the director. And so thinking about what those exclusions are and where the scope does and does not apply will be crucial. The fourth thing that we learned in the UK was if you're going to try and reduce the cost to business, you have to try and focus on the most number of businesses. And that basically means focus on small businesses. Small businesses, there are large numbers of small businesses in the economy, and they make up the vast majority of businesses. And also, small businesses are run often by entrepreneurs who are very busy, are the engine of innovation and growth of our future, of our economy, and reducing the burdens for that group of people can have particularly positive effects. And so a great deal of the effort in the UK was looking for ways to make it easier for small businesses to comply with regulations. The easier they found it to comply and the lower costs were for them, the more likely it was that agencies were able to achieve very significant reductions in, you know, in regulatory costs. And then the last lesson I'd say from the UK is engage others. You know, engage, you know, talk broadly to people who have expertise in this space if you're an agency looking for ways to reduce the regulatory costs. Talk with the business community and understand from the business community where the real burdens lie for businesses. In the UK, we found that often they were in a different place to where we had originally thought they were. And talk to the enforcement community and understand from the enforcement community which are the areas where they feel that it's possible to reform regulation and whilst maintaining protections and reducing costs. Often enforcers know that two regimes are duplicatory, that the businesses they meet day to day when they inspect a premises find a regime frustrating and confusing. And while they don't have the power to make it better, if their views were taken into account, then it would be easier for agencies to find ways to minimize costs whilst maintaining protections. So as the US embarks on this journey, there are certainly lessons from the UK and other countries. The UK is now 12 years into this system. As Susan said earlier, the system has evolved somewhat, and the current iteration of the system is a one-in-three-out system. It's certainly not perfect, and while a lot has been achieved, there's clearly more to be done. But one thing but there's certainly a great deal to learn from the experience of countries like the United Kingdom. One interesting point about the UK is that the original policies were introduced by a Labour government, a left-wing government, were then continued by a coalition government, and now are embraced by a conservative government. And so that continuity across party lines of policy has been one of the most interesting things about the UK experience. So with that, I'll stop and pass back over to Nate and Susan.
Okay, Susan, go ahead. Were there any additional comments you'd like to offer, or would you like to go to audience questions at this time?
Let me ask Jitender a question. I know we've talked before, and Jitender, you had mentioned that the UK set up, was it a private sector advisory committee of businesses, and did you think that that was a valuable component of your last point, and especially the engaging others?
Yeah, so there were a number of different ways in which we involved businesses. We had a group of businesses we had a group of business leaders who were the Better Regulation Commission, who gave us expert advice on ways in which we could improve the regulatory regime. In addition to that, as a group of policy officials, we spent a lot of time with business. I used to spend a day, a month, not talking to just a business association, but out with a genuine business on the ground, getting a good sense of how regulation felt, and that was an expectation not just of the leaders of my organization, but also, you know, every member of staff in the organization. And then the third thing we did is we had a group of external experts who, you know, started off as the trade associations and have now got a more formal role, whose job it was to validate any savings. So if an agency claimed that a set of changes had saved businesses £250 million a year, then those numbers had to be validated by an external organization. And in the early days, that was business, and now that's more of an independent expert committee, which includes business members. So, and I think that was all very, very important. The other thing the UK did, and is it crowdsourced from the business community and others for ideas of ways to improve the regulatory regime. So, you know, there were websites where people could come up with their ideas and suggestions of ways to improve the regime.
Yeah, that does sound important. So, Nate, I think I'm ready to open it up unless Jitender had a question for me.
Okay, very good. Let me begin that process. In a moment, you will hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to join the question queue, please enter star, then the pound sign. We have currently one caller waiting in the queue. And before we go to that call, let me just make one announcement regarding our Teleform schedule. Our next call will be tomorrow, the 10th, at 3 p.m. That call will be a special preview of the upcoming oral arguments in Hernandez v. Mesa. That call will feature Professor Andrew Kent, who is a professor of law at Fordham University School of Law, and also Professor Stephen I. Vladek, who is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. Okay, let's go to our first question of the day.
Hi, I'm wondering how collective goods like clean air, clean water, healthcare, things like that, or public health are handled in these regulations in other countries and how it's planned to be handled under the Trump order.
That's an interesting question, and it relates to one that I've heard from others, which is how did the benefits of regulations come into play with this executive order? And I think it's important that the agencies continue to do analysis to understand the benefits as well as the costs, and that this order, what it does is it just imposes a constraint on how much the cost can be. So while the order itself does not say this is a look that we're trying to look at incremental net costs, net of benefits, I don't think it does anything to undermine the fact that the Environmental Protection Agency, when it looks at which regulations it would like to introduce and which regulations it might be able to modify, it will still be thinking very much about the benefits of those regulations as well as the costs. And in fact, I think one of the things that I think the order will do is force a better analysis of the regulations that we've issued in the past. We have a tendency to analyze benefits and costs and based on modeling and assumptions before we have any information on what the rule will look like. And the incentives to look back and see whether those estimates that we made were right are just not very strong. That's, I think, the main thing this order does is it changes that incentive. And I hope and fully expect that agencies will take the opportunity to look at their existing regulations and find those that may not be producing those benefits that you mentioned as predicted, and that those might be the ones that can be modified before issuing something new. And that relates, I think, to something that Jitinder said, so I'm curious to hear him talk about it, that their focus was on modifying rather than eliminating and seeing what wasn't working as well as could be and try to reduce costs without reducing the benefits.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to add to that, in the UK, there's if you're a regulatory agency and you want to bring in a new regulatory proposal, the first thing you have to do is demonstrate that the benefits are significant and the costs are relevant and reasonable. So the benefits have to justify the costs in order for you to bring in a regulation. And then in addition to that, there was then a new requirement in the UK that said overall you could bring in a certain amount of additional cost. And certainly now that is every time you bring in £300 of additional cost, you have to take £100 of cost out. Every time you bring in £100 of additional cost, you have to take £300 of cost out from somewhere else in the system in relation to historic regulations. And certainly agencies in the UK are rightly very reluctant to take away protections. If they do that, they want to protect the environment, they want to protect workers, they want to achieve the public goods that the questioner talked about, but they also find that there are ways to achieve those, and often at lower cost to business, because the way in which the regulation has evolved over many years can sometimes be confusing, can sometimes be complex, and making it easier and simpler for people to understand, for businesses to understand, can often maintain those protections whilst minimizing costs. So you want to bring in regulation when the benefits justify the cost, and overall you want the benefits associated with regulation to be as high as possible, and you want the costs associated with regulation to be as low as possible.
Okay, thank you, caller, for your question. Right now, the audience queue is wide open. If you'd like to join it, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. One question I had in listening, Susan and Jatinder, is, you know, I understand Susan to say that this will result in better analysis, but I'm curious if you have a sense of how quickly agencies will be able to respond to the executive order. I mean, it seems like from what Jatinder said, in other countries there was more lead-up time and maybe more preparation to put a regulatory scheme like this in place. And I'm curious if you had any thoughts on the timing of all this and when Americans will begin to see changes as a result of the order.
Yeah, that's a good question. In our system, agencies have to follow the Administrative Procedure Act to change a regulation to, and that includes creating something new or modifying or eliminating. And that is an involved process that involves analysis to support a different decision, interagency review, public comment, and then evaluation of that comment, et cetera, before issuing a final regulation. And that generally takes at least a year. So removing new regulations takes as long as introducing new regulations. Not only from this order, but from other things we've heard from the president, I don't think this is going to be a very active year in issuing new regulations. As I mentioned in the call, I think one of the things this order does is direct agencies to turn their resources to looking at whether existing regulations are working as intended, or whether there are ways, as Jatinder noted, to reduce costs without reducing the benefits that the regulations provide. And that's going to be new to agencies. Generally, every president since President Carter has told agencies that they should look at the effects of their existing regulations and apply the analyses that they're required to apply to them as well as to new ones. And yet the motivation isn't there. In order to get a new regulation issued, agencies have to do some analysis, prospective analysis of benefits and costs. But once a regulation is in place, they don't have to think about it again and look at it again. And so it's hard to look retrospectively and measure regulatory impacts, and we haven't developed the same tools. So I think it's definitely going to be a year of learning how can we do that better. And Jatinder offered several illustrations of how it can be done, how it's been done in the UK.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I'd say if I was sitting in an agency right now, then the sort of obvious next step is to start looking for ways in which it's possible for agencies to minimize regulatory burden. So there could be places where forms could be redesigned, or where inspection resources are targeted targeted at all businesses or all businesses of a certain type. And actually, if you could establish more accurately which are the businesses that have the lowest risks, the highest risks, it would be easier to it would be possible to focus inspection resources at that group of businesses. Another thing that they might look at is using approaches like design thinking to sort of map how it feels to be at the receiving end of regulation, and then redesign that experience in a manner that could reduce costs and potentially even increase compliance. And so getting ahead of the game and get coming up with ideas and approaches across the regulatory, across the regulations that an agency is responsible for at this point feels like a good way forward. Otherwise, the risk that they face, agencies and agency officials that are rightly and understandably committed to their mission, is when they need to bring in a new regulation, they won't have anything to, they won't have anything in the bank in terms of reduced costs. They won't have any ideas ready, and if they won't have ideas ready, they won't be able to bring in the new regulations. And so that's the, it feels that you kind of have to get ahead of the game.
Okay, very good. We have one audience member waiting to ask a question. If you would like to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign. Let's go to our next question.
First, I want to thank you for a really good presentation and thank the Federalist Society. This is Roger Candelaria, and I have one question, but I'm approaching it kind of from two directions. One is looking at the CFR, Code of Federal Regulations, as a whole, where will this go? But the other way I'm kind of trying to ask the same question is, let's say that I have a question about a particular regulation. Let's take some Forest Service regulation on harvesting timber, small operations, maybe firewood or cordwood or something. How does that process ever get started for that particular regulation, and looked at in the collective? How is it going to affect the entire CFR as a piece of what, I don't know what it is now, 30 volumes or more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. So in terms of the process for identifying a regulation for possible removal, probably the first time that we would see that would be in the Unified Agenda that comes out twice a year that lists all the agency's upcoming regulatory activities. But ultimately, it should affect the number of pages, in the code itself. It's interesting because there are those, the two requirements of the executive order. One is you have to get rid of two whole rules for every one whole rule you bring in. Now, that could be the rules that are coming in and out could have very different impacts on the code. And then the other piece is the cost, and that is one for one rather than two for one. Both of those I can imagine either reducing or slowing the increase in the number in the code itself, the number of volumes or number of pages. But it's not clear to me exactly what the final outcome will be. But I think the goal of this incremental cost cap of zero is not to increase the code, at least in this first year.
Well, as a follow-up, maybe Jed Kinder wants to comment on this first, but I have a follow-up.
Yeah, sure. So let me just add something to that. The experience of the UK and a number of other countries is that the key is to try and measure the actual costs of regulation and to try and make the costs of regulation, make sure that they're fair and proportionate and no more than they need to be for the protections that we want in society. And while politicians often talk about the number of pages of regulation or the number of regulations, there isn't a very good correlation between the number of pages or the number of regulations and the actual cost. A regulation that is very simple and short but impacts on a very large number of businesses but doesn't take up very many pages could impose very significant costs. A regulation that is very complex but touches a very small number of businesses could impose very small costs despite having a large number of pages. And so the approach that most countries have taken is to focus first and foremost, when looking at cumulative costs, is to focus on the costs that's faced by business. And also they found that often it's possible to change those costs without making any changes to the underlying regulation. The compliance costs for business are driven to some extent by what's in the law and in the CFR type equivalent or on the statute books in the UK, but to a large extent driven by the manner in which the enforcement community and the regulatory community enforces that regulation and the way in which the regulation kind of transpires And so in the UK, we found there were very few examples where there were significant changes made to the regulatory language, but there were a much larger number of examples where it was possible to modernize and streamline regulation in ways that were more in the kind of the manner in which it was implemented. And my sense is that it's too early to know what will happen in the United States, but I certainly would say that the approach in the UK has the ability to be sustainable over longer periods of time than approaches that are more politicized.
Well, thank you. That's helpful, and that kind of points to my follow-up, and that is, I'm sure that nobody in the administrative state would consider gaming the system, but what would keep an administrative agency from essentially just renumbering their regulations so that they have fewer when the regulations are just as burdensome as the current ones?
I guess I have two answers to that. One is that I think that there are two components, as I mentioned, to the order, and one is the number, it's strictly a number of regulation question, and then the second one is incremental cost. And I think so one of my answers is the incremental cost, which gets to what Jatinder was talking about. Is the cost fair and proportionate to the benefits, and can we reduce the cost in that way? The second answer is a more institutional, and that answer is that it's OMB. So the order gives the director of OMB and the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs the responsibility for ensuring the order, that agencies comply with it. So it will be OMB and OIRA within OMB that is being the final arbiter on whether agencies have adequately identified offsetting regulations and offsetting costs.
Very good. Thank you.
And just to add to that, so if we do a worked example, if an agency wanted to bring in a new regulation which imposes $200 million worth of cost, that would certainly require, that would certainly kick, the 1-in-2-out requirement would certainly kick in at that point. So if there's $200 million of annualized cost associated with that regulation, there's a requirement to find two places to reduce costs. Two outs need to be found. And to Susan's point, they could be small. They could potentially be ones that regulations that impose $5 million of cost each. And so, taken literally, 1-in-2-out in that way would impose $200 million of cost and take $2.5 million worth of costs out. So now we're up $190 million. The interesting part of the order, and I think the more powerful part of the executive order, is the requirement for no increase in the overall cumulative costs, what I call the net zero requirement. And that requirement is that if you bring in $200 million worth of cost, you've got to find $200 million somewhere else in annualized business costs. And while a great deal of the coverage in the media has been around the 1-in-2-out, the more powerful part of the executive order is really this net cap of zero on overall regulatory costs. So I think that's going to be the bigger constraint, and it's easier to understand and probably harder to gain.
Okay, very good. We currently have one person waiting in the queue to ask a question. If you would like to join the queue to ask a question of Jatinder Kohli or Professor Susan Dudley, please do so by entering star and the pound sign. Let's go to our next question.
Hello.
You're on.
Yes, hi. Paul Kamnar calling in. Hi, Susan.
Hey, Paul.
Join this later after the call starts. I'm not sure you all got to it, but what do you think of the lawsuit filed yesterday by Public Citizen challenging the executive order and the OMB interim guidance? I don't know if you had a chance to look at that, but they're challenging on a number of grounds that it violates separation of powers, the take care clause, some statutes, et cetera. Have you taken a look at that yet?
I have, Paul, but I'm going to be interested in what you think because you are a lawyer and neither Jitender nor I are. But I think it's interesting that they filed a comment, but I'm not sure that, you know, in your words, that it would be ripe since it hasn't really resulted in any actions by the agency. So there's no injury, no concrete injury, and so it's not clear to me exactly how that would work.
Yeah.
Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, yeah. Well, for a non-lawyer yourself, I think you got it right. Yeah, it does look like it's not ripe. They claim that it's final agency action in the sense of the interim guidance being issued, et cetera. But I think they have some problems with ripeness, and, of course, that's part of the standing issue. But it looks like, it's being teed up for whenever any of the regulations that are being subject to being revoked are going to be, actually challenged or removed from the books, et cetera. So it seems that they're setting it up at least to get this going, and then we'll amend the complaint or whatever as the case.
Mm-hmm.
But
possibly signaling to the agencies. You know, the previous caller said that agencies may, be motivated not to comply fully with the executive order or to game it, and this may be signaling to the agencies, here we are ready if you do something, to support you if you do something that we think is inconsistent with your statutory authority.
Right. And if I may ask sort of a related question that's your expertise as well, and that is the status of the regulations that are being subject to the Congressional Review Act. Can you give us sort of a little summary of what's happened in the last a week or two, having those regulations revoked by Congress?
Well, I actually haven't looked since yesterday. And as of yesterday, there were two that had a joint resolution of disapproval, so signed by both houses of Congress, and several more in the works. Related to this executive order, one of the things that OMB's guidance says is that those actions disapproved through the CRA will count as offsetting regulations for the two-for-one as well as for the incremental cost cap.
Great. Yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question, but you anticipated it. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you for your question, Paul. I would note to our audience that we are looking to set up a separate telephone conference on the CRA in the next week or two. So please do watch out for emails announcing that call, and you can also consult our full schedule of telephone conference calls at fedsoc.org. And, of course, all our previously recorded calls are there as podcasts, so you can check them out. We have one caller waiting to ask a question. Let's go to that question now. Please go ahead, caller.
Yeah, hi, it's Michael Hertz. Hi, Susan. Just thanks for doing this. So my question goes to this question of the executive order's reference to repealing regulations, because one of the things Mr. Coley has now said many times is that the British experience was there was frequently possible to find cost savings without repealing rules, and in some cases without even changing their text, but rather changing the way they were implemented or fine-tuning them in certain ways. And at least on the face of the executive order, that just seems like it's not allowed, because what it requires is a repeal. And I'm just wondering, is that how you read the executive order? Do you think OIRA's guidance will leave room for modifications rather than repeals, or even simply change to, for example, guidance about a regulation, but the regulation remains intact? Or are the only permissible cost savings those that literally flow from a repeal, in which case the British experience, we can't take, it's not, it seems not available to us.
Mm-hmm. I'll be curious what Jitendra thinks about this too. The way I read the order and the draft guidance is that what you're saying is true for the two-for-one constraint, that they have to find two regulations to repeal. I don't think that's going to be trivial, but that is something they have to do. But in terms of the cost savings, which I think is going to be the more binding and difficult constraint, I don't think they actually have to remove a regulation. They can modify one. It's an interesting concept to actually modify it without changing the code itself. Because the U.S. is different from a parliamentary system, it's hard to map exactly what a law in the UK compares to, you know, whether it's our code of federal regulations or whether it's the statutory language that's directly comparable. So maybe in the US there still does require some changes to the text of the regulation. I do think that there are opportunities to reduce costs without repealing, but there is that other constraint which agencies will have to find ways to reduce two for one. Now, it may be that that's something that gets worked out at the, you know, each fiscal year, and that an agency that issues three will have to find six to remove, but it doesn't have to be each, you know. There may be different ways of getting around that. I think that's the less interesting of the two constraints, and I think listening to Jitendra, he agrees.
Yeah, just to add to that, I think certainly the more important constraint, as we talked about earlier, is the net zero, and it's clear that that constraint, which will have, I think, the greater impact on agencies, allows you to look more broadly at regulatory costs, not just elimination as the only mechanism to reduce regulatory costs. Indeed, you could have situations where, even though you eliminate a regulation, the actual reduction in costs is low because businesses continue to operate in the same way as they would have done had the regulation been in place, because it's become more sort of custom and practice in the way businesses work. A common example people use is airbags. If you were to remove the requirement to, you know, for cars to have airbags, would car manufacturers continue to have airbags in their vehicles? I assume they would, but maybe they wouldn't. And certainly in the UK system, the only thing that would count is the real cost saving to business associated with the change. And I think there's a lot more that needs to be worked out about exactly what the executive order means. And there are certainly some sections of it which, if you read carefully, they appear to say very clearly that every time you bring in one new regulation, you have to take two regulations out by eliminating them. There are one or two other places that are a bit more ambiguous, where there's an implication that the reduction of costs associated with a regulation might count as an out. And so I think that there's more work to be done within the administration to establish what it really means.
Okay, thank you, caller, for your question. We have two people currently waiting in the queue, so let's get to the next question.
Hello, my name is Carolyn Carlotta. It seems to me that it's very difficult when you had to determine the cost of these regulations. A lot of the agencies really lowball the anticipated cost when they pass the regulation. So they say it'll cost, you know, $200 million. It actually costs $1.5 billion. How is this to, who determines this? How is it to be determined? How can anybody be sure that the reduction in cost actually occurs?
Yeah, I'll answer briefly, prospectively, and Jitendra can maybe tell us a little bit more about the UK. OMB's initial interim guidance says that you can't, the agencies can generally not rely on their ex ante estimates, that they should really look and see what the real cost burden is. And as Jitendra says, in the UK, not just that, but what if we removed the regulation, what would happen? How would that affect your costs. So that means that for regulations that impose large upfront capital costs, the companies that already made those investments, those costs are sunk, and that won't be a savings. So that's OMB's initial guidelines on that. It does not mean it's easy. I think that you're right. It's going to be complicated, and it's going to be complicated in particular because we really haven't done it before.
And I think it's definitely difficult and something that the United Kingdom learnt by doing. So in the UK, agencies were required to produce estimates of the cost savings associated with the regulatory simplification. And those estimates were typically, done in the order of this will, so many businesses are likely, have reduced costs. Our estimate of reduced costs for those businesses is based on talking to this kind of business and getting a sense of what the new costs will be after the changes occurred and what the cost savings are for that business. And so coming up with those kind of estimations, agencies were able to say, the impact of the change we're making is a reduced cost of say £100 million. Having done that in the UK, the cost savings had to be validated, and initially the validation was done by a group of by business trade associations. So our small business associations and our large business associations sat together. And sat with agencies and said, yep, that number makes sense and we're willing to validate that number, and occasionally did not validate that number. But I think, I can't remember the number exactly, but my recollection is definitely north of 90%, maybe even 95% of costs were validated, or cost savings were validated. So the vast majority of savings estimates by agencies were validated because agencies were pretty good at doing those estimates. Over time, that process wasn't done by convening a group of people in an ad hoc manner, but is now done by an organization called the Regulatory Policy Committee, which is an independent organization comprised of experts in the estimation of costs and benefits. And they play a role both in terms of estimating, both in terms of validating the benefits and the costs associated with brand new regulations, but also a role by validating the benefits, the cost savings associated with any regulatory simplifications that agencies want to claim towards the numerical goals that they're set.
Okay, we are starting to run a little short on time. Let's make this next question our last question of the day.
Hey, this is Tom Selman. The other side of this position, I guess the consumer groups would say that this is a unidirectional move, essentially a deregulatory move. Is there ever, this may be a silly question actually, but has there ever been consideration of not only saying that the addition of costs would mean that there would have to be a reduction of costs elsewhere, but that the reduction of a benefit would have to be replaced by the addition of a benefit elsewhere?
I'm not aware of that approach at all. But the one thing I would say is that the UK experience was that consumer groups were heavily involved in both shaping the agenda that the government had when I was responsible for it, and also were very clearly a partner in the way we implemented the agenda. So to give you one example, one of the things that regulations often require are warnings before people buy things. So there could be warnings, that you see that often in financial services, where there are warnings produced to help consumers make better decisions. And you see it in a number of other places too. And we, for example, we in government felt, and our consumer groups felt, that those warnings were often ineffective. They were written in ways that consumers didn't understand. They led to no change. They led to less change in behaviour than was intended, and far from providing the protections that were intended. They led instead to just bureaucracy and burden and confusion. And so the government, we worked closely with consumer groups to publish, to do a detailed study of how to design those kind of warnings in a way that impacted on behavior whilst minimizing costs. And you know, that's a report you can find online. I think it's called Too Much Information Can Do Harm. And it will give you a bit of a sense of the way in which collaboration with consumer groups was crucial to the to the UK approach.
I actually think that's a great way to end the call. That this, if done right, this has the potential to really target the benefits, the things that we care about, and to do it as cost effectively as possible. To require that retrospective evaluation to know whether we are achieving the benefits that we predicted.
Excellent. Jitinder, any further closing thoughts?
No, I'd encourage people to read that report or at least look it up on Google, because it's kind of fun to – it's got probably the most unusual cover of a government report that anyone's ever seen. And you can find it by just typing in "too much information and better regulation" into Google.
Okay, very good. We will do so. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Jitinder Kohli and Professor Susan Dudley for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.